Hey, everybody, I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. And welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help others to achieve sobriety. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them. I am one of them, too. I must have this thing. All right, our speaker tonight, I'm thrilled to realize that I do know who she is. This program's great. You have a lot of first names, but no last names. So everyone kept saying, you know Nikki. And she walked in the door and go, oh, Nikki. So I give you guys Nikki, whose home group is the Thursday night women's meeting that meets behind the curtain.
Hi, guys. My name is Nikki D, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date was Super Bowl Sunday, 1992. And I actually can't even tell you what date that was. I just know that was the day that I looked and realized that I was drinking a beer. I hate beer. I never drink beer. And there wasn't enough beer to get me drunk or happy. And there wasn't enough anything else to get me drunk or happy. And I was on the verge of being in trouble with the law to where because I had a brand new infant. And I realized that at that point I had to say, stop and do something, or really kind of just blow off the whole baby thing and go out there and get it done and finish it off. So I stopped. My first group I came to was Friday Night Frights, which we no longer have. And it was pretty cool. I used to sit in here and cry. There was another woman who would sit in here and cry with me. And all we could talk about was how crappy our husbands were. So for the first year, I think I was here just complaining about him and him alone. And then slowly the door starts to open and you start seeing yourself in other people's voices and stories. I was one of four children. My brothers are 7 and 9 years older than me, and I have a little sister 5 years younger than me. So I kind of got to be an only child because the boys were always like on the new stage of either going to high school, going away to the services, going to college. I come from a long, fine line of alcoholics and drug addictions. And I, too, inherited it and did a good job fine-tuning. I never have really studied hard as to why I'm an alcoholic. It just is a habit that developed. It was a bad habit. And I just didn't really see a value in the why. You know, what was missing in my life? Well, it was alcohol. It always was alcohol. So slowly over the years, if nothing, the program has taught me to retrain myself with a new set of habits, a new set of abilities to reach out and be a friend to somebody rather than be a cohort and a accomplice. My parents, my dad was a really successful vice president of Swifting Company. I don't know if anybody remembers Butterball or Swift Meats or whatever. My dad was the big guy there. And he was a short little man like me, looked just like James Cagney, caused a lot of problems, always had a girlfriend, had 5 wives, had lots of money, all the wives got the money. No, I'm not a rich kid. The bad thing about it was he was also a violent person. So early on, he learned that you could not bring playmates home you know, unless they wanted to see really fine furniture being thrown all over the house, or knives, or whatever was handy. It got really violent in my house. And, of course, when the police would come, because you're, like, better off, no one goes to jail. They just settle everybody down, and they leave. And then it starts right back up. So there's a plus and a downside to being sometimes the people that are the haves, you know. A lot can go on before anything really crashes and burns. But when my parents got a divorce, I finally let loose. I was born in New Jersey. My dad worked in New York City, traveled back and forth every day. So we were the nice little suburbs, and, you know, all the kids got penguins when they turned 16, cars so they could go sailing. And so I was in third grade. We transferred to Chicago. And Dad started doing the Swift & Company side of union organizing. So he was the management side. So it's a pretty hairy job. And so we lived in the suburbs of Chicago. And I learned at that point what alcohol could do for you. I had one drink when I was really young. Not one drink. Actually, I had just watched the Beach Party Bingo movie. Okay? And do you remember the part in it where the girl goes, "This is fruit," and she's drinking, and she picks up all these clear liquids, clear liquors, and she goes, "Fruit," and she keeps tossing them. Well, I did a rendition of that at this party that I crashed when I was about 10 or 11, and I probably almost killed myself with alcohol poisoning, but that was my first memory of ever taking a drink. After that, it was me, Mom, and my little sister, and my mother had pretty much gone the way of a dry drunk. And so we still had a lot of violence in the house. And I finally got to the point where I had run away so many times. I was in court, and my mother blew up and went into a quote-unquote violent rage. Judge Nolan, bless his heart, grabbed me, took me into his chambers and said, "I know who your dad is. I'm sending you to a really nice boarding school." And, I mean, it was cool. I was so grateful, except for the month I had to spend in Lake County Correctional waiting to go to boarding school, which was hairy. But anyway, so I got to boarding school, Catholic convent, three convents, and it's a whole new world. I mean, I have not even made it through middle school yet. But it's like not in the world. You know, it's a big convent. There's a huge church, a huge gym, a huge swimming pool, roller skating rink, movie theater, and you never went outside, you know. So it was just us, the girls, the 200 nuns, and it became my hobby, and I was safe. For probably the first time in my life, I felt safe. And then nuns have this unconditional love thing. That's really cool. No matter what you do, they will love you anyway. And it was really neat, because after about a year, I gave up lying, because they knew everything you did anyway, because there was really not that much to do. And so I just learned the benefit of not lying at that point. And I also kind of learned the benefit of the unconditional love. I started making, and in boarding school, I mean, it was pretty cool. We had Peaches, Bernadette McKay was there. And Bernadette had made the error of going on tour with the Fifth Dimension to Europe, and she was 12. When she came home, she went to St. Joseph's Academy for Girls. My roommate, Terry, she got picked up in Berkeley, California. Her father was head of, human resources for the Berkeley, California College. And she got picked up in the riot, "Hell no, nobody goes," for the Vietnam thing, with her five little brothers and sisters. That's how she got to boarding school. Zabeth Tiling was my roommate, and both her parents taught at MIT. And they had never had an argument. That's why she went to boarding school. They were shrinks. She had never seen them have a discussion, harsh discussion, argument. She was ready to kill someone. So, you know, we're all pretty lively characters. And we had a good time. IBM came in and put in one of their first teaching machines, which is why I got to go to college. And it was their first experience. It was like a room you went in, and there was two consoles, and they programmed you into it, and you did nothing but math. And I did that for 2 years. And when I graduated from boarding school, I had such a high score that I got a full scholarship at the University of Nebraska, tuition, books, and supplies for as long as I wanted to go. Well, theoretically for 4 years. I went for five. No one noticed that I never did graduate. And there was not any really good oversight, nor did I realize you really needed a counselor to tell you what to do in order to, you know. So I've been kind of, you know, tooling around at sea all those years of my youth with not a lot of oversight or an ability to go to a counselor's office and say, so what do I need to get a degree? You know? So I was like a double major, physics and fine arts, which doesn't meet any place on any of the scoreboards for cross classes. So in my senior year, actually, I made it to senior year. I got married. My girlfriend got married. My best friend got married. She had a great wedding. That's what I wanted, was this wedding. Had it at the same place. I really didn't want to get married. I wanted the wedding. You know, I'll admit it. I wanted the dress, the wedding. You know. I wanted to actually pretend like I had a normal family, like I had grown up at home, like I had gone home for Christmases, you know. And that was the one difference in boarding school is I never went home. I never went back. I didn't speak to my mom again until I was about 22. So that was a little bit different. You know, I was kind of an oddball then. During boarding school, I started having seizures. When I was a kid, they diagnosed me with petit mal. And so they gave me a drug. And during boarding school, at some point, I started having seizures. So they started feeding me phenobarbital. And I had a lot of, I was like on 540 mics of phenobarbital a day, if anybody, and I'm still functioning, so I have a real high tolerance on pain on that. So I never did drink. When I was 21, actually when I was 18, a Dr. Green in Omaha, Nebraska, decided he was going to alpha beta wave train me and take me off of phenobarbital, which worked. I'm drug free, I don't have to take anything for epilepsy. Haven't had a seizure since I was like 21. But during all those years when I was growing up between 13 and 18, when you're on that much phenobarbital, you don't mature. You don't go through puberty. You don't go through any physical changes, actually, let alone mental changes. And you don't notice a whole lot. I just really liked boarding school. You know? So here I get to college. I am completely inexperienced. I don't know anything. Don't know how to date. Don't know how to talk to guys. It was just really scary. Played bridge in the Wompy Room till I almost flunked out. The Wompy Room was full of Vietnam vets from Offutt Air Force Base and from Fort Omaha, which is the Navy in Omaha. And these are people coming back from Vietnam that weren't allowed out of the service. So we all sat in the Wompy Room and silently played bridge. You know, that's how I found out how bad Vietnam was, because no one wanted to talk about it. It had to be really bad. And people eventually did talk about it a little bit. So I guess the phenobarbital really kind of describes my first adventure into avoiding reality chemically. I was free of phenobarbital, and I got my first job while I was still in college. And actually, it was my second job, but it was at the observatory. The observatory was 1972's version of Hooters with less clothes. And so here I am, a physics major, but, you know, right before I'm going to work, so anyway, everybody in the physics department was really afraid of me, terrified. I was the only one who wore makeup, but boy. And, you know, I'd go to work and I'd have pigtails on and stuff. That was really effective. And just not really aware of the environment I was in a lot of situations. So I put myself in a lot of harm that way just by being complicitly naive. Is that a good way to put that? Like, oh, I'm a little girl in college in physics. You know? Yeah, right. Well, you should put some clothes on. Lots of things happen to us, you know. During our drinking time, we can look back and we're amazed at the things that we created, the dangers we created, and we survived. I survived quite a few really dangerous ones. I was snatched by three Hell's Angels and taken for a couple days. God works in mysterious ways. I don't know if anybody remembers the Hong Kong flu. It was like our N1 thing. I got the Hong Kong flu. Have you ever tried to violently rape somebody with the Hong Kong flu? It just doesn't work the way they wanted it to. I'm not saying bad things didn't happen, but I'm sure they didn't have the fun they thought they were going to have, you know. And I came home pretty unscathed because I was completely out of it. I mean, I was out of it. If anybody ever had that other bad flu, you know, you were just not of this planet. So, to me, I can look back on it and I can see God right there. Because, man, if I was alive and well, they would have had to have killed me, you know. And they didn't kill me because I was like, you know, too messed up. I was in a gun battle. I spent bartending one night. And I was still in college for all of this. Get this. And Sunday night, and the guy comes to the back door, and we're locking up, and he's got a gun, and he puts it in my neck like that. We get robbed. The bad thing was the gun was like this, and I can feel the barrel because the guy is so scared. That's a bad feeling. And I found I could completely relax with a barrel in my neck. I did. And Ronnie Benassi was freaking out. I'm going, shut up, Ronnie, turn the key to the right, you know. So I lived through that. Lived through another gun battle. Lived through, I ran away from boarding school and was picked up in the middle of the riot down on Wells Street during the Martin Luther King riot. So I lived through that. That was scary. Riots are scary. Holy cow. So through all my drinking, I've seen all these wild things, you know, and survived them all just by luck, just by the grace of God. And like I said, like some of the worst things, I can look back and say, I was not around anybody who had the Hong Kong flu. I don't know where it came from. I don't know how I hope they got it, but, you know, I mean, but I don't think I would have lived had that not happened. So I drift here. I knew I should have written out notes. So we're at the part where I get married. My husband's a lawyer. He's in law school. One night, we're going home, and he tells me that he's going to divorce me because, you know, really all I wanted was the wedding. And we had a car accident, and he died. And whether I participated in the accident or not, I'll never know. I'll always be very concerned. I was in a coma for 10 days, so I really wasn't even awake when they buried him. So, boom, you get to start your life all over again. So at that point, I moved to Texas, and between when Daryl died and when I moved to Texas, friends of mine owned a sprinkler piping company that did sprinkler systems, and they taught me how to draw a pipe. So I went to Texas, and I got to draw a pipe on all these high-rise buildings. It was great, and I got I was a widow, so I had money, you know, and cowboy boots and a cowboy hat, and, you know, wow, I was off to the races. I could drink, I could get high, I hung out with the survey crew, they snorted coke all the time, and of course this is why we did, some of the tunnels didn't quite work, but it was really neat though. I really enjoyed drawing pipe, I really enjoyed high-rise buildings, but the days of the high-rise buildings, you know, come to an end. And I decided to try marriage again. So I married Mr. Executive, you know, like you're supposed to end up. And married Mr. Executive, moved to Atlanta, Georgia, continued to drink and drug, and he married the next-door neighbor. That was a bummer. So here I was 30-some years old, and I'm in a one-bedroom apartment. I've got enough shit for a five-bedroom house. I can drink a whole lot, and another friend out of nowhere teaches me computers. Well, my ex was a big computer guy, so I kind of learned it out of vengeance, you know. So for the next many, many years, I sold computers, built computers, rented computers, leased minis, learned about networks and blah, 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 blah. And I did computers for about the next 20 years. During that time, I stayed pretty much single the whole time until 1991. And I was sitting in a bar, and it was getting to be closing time, and I was in between two guys, and I should have done this. Anyway, To my right is a pilot, and he's going to be on a plane in a while, so I know I can't pick him up. And to my left is this other guy, who turns out to be the father to my daughter. And, you know, we married the same drunk we are, basically. He was a controlling, self-willed, always correct. He was exactly like me, and I hated him really bad. We're good friends now, though, actually. So we have a daughter, and I stayed sober through the pregnancy. I stayed sober for the first month and a half. And then they gave a wedding reception at my apartment complex, and I drank, I think, maybe 11 or 12 White Russians, and I went home, and I beat the shit out of my husband, and they called the police, and I almost lost my kid. And the judge sentenced me to AA, and that's how I started in the program. So here's all the horror stories. So I get to the program, and, you know, and it's not me. It's that I didn't grow up in home. I didn't have parents. My husband's an alcoholic, you know. But when you really think back on my life, I'd been stoned from 13 to 18, graduated from there to alcohol and other substances. So I really kind of just grew up on a pattern of non-reality. Anything to avoid reality. Anything to avoid really making a plan and sticking to it or being responsible. Now, I was always cash register honest. But that's about as far as honesty went. I never really could take a full look at what I was doing, who I was affecting. So I started the program in 1992. Didn't, no burning bush, no big got here and bitched about my husband for the first year. And then I finally listened to somebody else bitch about their husband. I thought, God, that's disgusting. So I shut up, and I started listening to what other people had to say. And the more I listened, the more I started hearing little things about my story here and there. And I have to admit, I told you guys everything tonight I said I would never tell anybody, so you're my new fifth step. But, and speaking of which, steps. I did the steps really slowly, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I was really, sometimes slowly. And, I did the steps really slowly. But a fifth step, it's kind of like, it's like your own history. When I look back at my history, I keep going, oh, I didn't have parents. I look back and I'm really grateful now I didn't have parents. I'm really grateful I didn't have to live in that hellhole anymore. I don't care how much money they had. I would have been dead. You know, she would have finally connected the crowbar with my head. And the fifth step is kind of like a redo like that, too. Each time I go back and I do my fifth step over again, a lot of times it's over the same stuff, but it's different. It's clearer. It's cleaner. I get a better result. And when I hit rough times, and this is kind of where, you know, we have done all these horrible things when we were drinking to get in trouble, you know, things that we stole and robbed and lied and cheated and... but it was mostly our own doing. All of a sudden, I get sober, and all this stuff happens that I could have never handled drunk. And there's been quite a few of them that have happened that I could have never handled drunk. I have a child who's handicapped. And that's going to be a lifelong difficulty for me. I can't really even talk about it, nor am I going to, but my oldest brother, who was in Vietnam, committed suicide. That was about 4 years ago. And a lot of veterans do. A lot of veterans do after years and years and years. He was in Vietnam quite a while. I can't say Vietnam is the reason he killed himself. It's probably one of the reasons he lost his way in life. But had I been drunk, I could have never dealt with that. And it's funny because the more difficult stuff gets, the more all of a sudden, instead of freaking out and going, I can't take this, you go, oh. And you realize you don't have to do anything. The bigger the crisis, the less you got to do. The longer you got to sit back and just wait for something to come about that makes sense. Get on the phone, whatever. But had I been drinking, who knows what I would have done. I have no idea. I probably would have destroyed the rest of the people in the family. Who cares? So,
Am I ending really too soon here?
Oh, come on. I don't have to make stuff up now.
No. So, in the program, I found calling people is really hard. All of us know that. But we all finally break down one day in pain and do it and go, it's not that bad. So I'm continuing to do that. Getting a sponsor was critical to me doing a fifth step, although the first couple sponsors I picked weren't quite right. Both of them went back out, and it went back out in a big way. One was never in the program. I don't know how I picked her for a sponsor, but she was the one who told me when I did my fifth step that sometimes you need to talk to a psychiatrist about this stuff. And I was like, no, that's not what you're supposed to tell me. Yeah, so luckily I was my obnoxious self, and I went, I have to go find a different sponsor. This isn't right. and I did. So, and I've been very lucky to have some really good sponsors in the program. Helen passed away, and she was always very wise. But having the most popular wise sponsor sometimes isn't the best way to go. So you can always have more than one sponsor. Remember that. If you're not getting everything you need from one, have another one. There's no rule that says you can't. Coming back to meetings is about the most important thing to keep me sober. You know, I was never one at making plans. I always was really jealous about the guy who went, I'm going to start up a business, da, da, da. You know, people who could make plans, I was so envious of them. They could plan their life out. I sat with the girl who planned her life out. She married John Schmaltz, da, 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 da. And it was like, from the moment she met him, everything turned out the exact way she said, except she ended up divorced. But it was like, but to have somebody in front of you that can sit down and make a plan like that and then carry it out is just so enviable. I've never been able to do that. And I've always thought, that's why I'm a failure, because I can't make that plan. And as I said, when we look back on our past, our opinion of what it is changes. And my opinion is now much different, because now I can see, you know, I'm not one of those guys that's going to make a lifetime plan. I'm not going to plan and get the summer home. I'm not going to plan the retirement and end up in Barbados or Costa Rica. But what I can plan for is today and my sobriety and keeping an open mind and an open heart of trying to remember as I flip the guy off in my car that he might have a gun. And that I'm way too old to do this, and it's very alcoholic to do it. So, you know, making that plan, saying, okay, the next time it happens, I won't do that. But that's also part of this growing up process. You know, as I said, I developed a bad habit of non-reality way young in life, of doing whatever it took to avoid being uncomfortable with reality. As we're sober, we realize reality isn't all that bad. It's just not a lot of fun sometimes. My reality is when I get up in the morning, and right now I'm not working, so I have a bad problem of getting lost. I don't have any regular schedule to my day, which is horrible. Don't do this. Is to always remember, if I've got nothing to do and I'm at a loss, go to a meeting. If I've got nothing to do and I'm at a loss, call somebody. Go try to do services someplace. I guess that's my next phase of life will be to do that. I have learned now that I'm not working, I take care of dogs, which is very interesting. They are not good to talk to. I love dogs dearly. They are crappy at conversation, and you actually have to have people in your life. The part of being sober that keeps me here every day is you guys and listening to you guys. And listening to you guys when you're in pain and how you're working through it, how you're living through that day's dilemma. And like I said, I don't have any long-term plans, but the short-term plan was given to me by the 12 steps. And if I stick to those, like I said, each time I go through and relive history isn't quite as weird as it once was. My fifth step isn't quite as goofy. I can be more realistic. I can be more honest. In boarding school, I was the little Miss Honesty girl. Here's an embarrassing one. I spent my time in boarding school looking at the nuns trying to figure out why they joined a convent. I mean, it's really, why would you join a convent? Especially the cloistered nuns who can't talk. You know, why on God's earth would you do anything where you couldn't talk? And I cleaned chapel because I wasn't Catholic, and I didn't have to genuflex, so I could clean more and faster, and Mother Divine Heart was very happy with her square fingers and, you know. So anyway, I cleaned a hallway. This nun cleaned one side, I cleaned the other side. I timed it every day so I could be in the same. And each day I would bring her up, because I forget, I couldn't read the newspaper. If they can't talk, I'm sure they can't watch TV, read a newspaper, or do anything else. So every day I'm keeping her up to tune on Vietnam and what's going on and the presidents and this and that and the other. 2 years down the road, I paused, and I must have said something that was a question, and she turned around and answered me. And I was like, what? And I found out she could talk 15 minutes a day, and she'd been waiting for 2 years to talk to me. But with my ego and my, you know. And it was pretty cool. A lot of nuns, you know, when you talk to them, and you're like, well, and you have to understand, if you're not Catholic, anyway, when you marry Christ and become a nun, you do the wedding dress and the whole bit. I'm glad I didn't know that before I got married. I'd be a nun. But she actually didn't have a brain bush. She said it was the depression, and this was the only place I could go to eat, which I thought was profound that she was that honest, but she's also that dedicated. I mean, she made the little wafers and the priest stuff, and she's a very happy person. So boarding school in a lot of ways was cool, and I'll always be grateful for it, even though it wasn't like having mom and dad. There's no prom, there's no dating, there's no high school. But from what I hear, other people not attending high school probably wasn't a bad thing. Heard it pretty brutal. So that's one of my other embarrassing stories. And other than that, being in the program has saved my life. I get to be a mom. I'm a pretty decent ex-wife. You know, I don't know if anybody's got a nasty marriage out there and a nasty divorce. Being a good ex-wife is cool. And I have a home. I take care of dogs. I come to meetings regularly. And I talk to people. And I wouldn't be here today except for you guys. I wouldn't have survived any of this. My dad's passed away many, many years now. My dad was old when I was born. He was born in, like, 1921. No, I think we figured he'd be right at 100 now. So, I still have a brother and a little sister. They live in Wisconsin and Iowa. My mom lives in Cummings, Georgia. After all those years of not speaking to her, as I got older, she actually moved down south, and we have a very good relationship now, and it's cool. I have the mom I always wanted, and it's not anything like we expected. So all the plans that we grow up with, this is the way it's supposed to be, and you go, oh, it's not like that, have turned out okay. And I have to say I'm a very happy person now. I could be happier. I could win the lotto. Yeah. But as it is, I've got a roof over my head. I've got a potential to where I can work. I'm not looking at prison straight up. Well, thank you all. I love it.
John, will you give out the tips for me, please?
Sure. My name's John. I'm an alcoholic. Everybody. Thank you. I enjoyed that. These tips are just little symbols of how long you're away from a drink. If you're coming in the program or you want to not take a drink the rest of the day, we offer a white chip to you. Anybody want a white chip? Okay. Has anybody got 30 days for a silver chip? All right. Hey, that's a big deal for an alcoholic, man. 30 days, you know. Stick around. Let some of us, you know, talk to you. All right. Anybody got 90 days for a red chip? All right. How about 6 months for a yellow chip? Anybody? The pregnant chip, 9 months. Uh-oh. Oh, Jeff's got it. All right. And, of course, it's green, which is go for the blue chip for a year or multiples. Anybody got a birthday besides Pat?
I'm Frank Waters, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm also known as Kat's dad, and this is her 5-year chip. Kat wasn't a hot mess when she got here. She was just really screwed up and just a big mess. She survived. She's been good to herself, even though she didn't want to most of the time. And as a dad, I have to remind her to be good to herself, and I have to piss her off. I wasn't raised up in that, how you feel, Frank, kind of AA. I was raised up by mean alcoholics, from what I understand. So I'm a little bit mean to Kat. But she has gone through a lot this past year, and she survived it. Kat's craziness, her neighbor's craziness, the world's craziness. For the most part, she's sane. And she's better. And she's somebody that people look up to. And I had nothing to do with that. That's all Kat and God. So. And I'm proud of her. Happy birthday.
Hey, y'all. I'm Kat. I'm an alcoholic. And this is 5. You know, like he was saying, this year was a difficult year for me, and the reason I made it was because of you guys and because of staying involved. Being sober is really fucking hard, but I'm doing it one day at a time. And sometimes 1 minute at a time, sometimes it's 1 second at a time, but I'm doing it. Every day it adds up, and it has now added up to 5 years. Thank you, guys.
Just to make sure, is anybody sure they don't want to pick up a white chip today? Just want to make sure that they were paying attention. Anybody? All right. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting.
On. my sleeve. It'll never leave if I give it and drag cocaine. If you want love all the time, give it.